Live from the Wholesaling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. It's time for Darren, Donick, and Chase. Sponsored by Blue Note Juke Joint. Smoother than smooth. With hosts Darren McFarland, Willie Donick, and Chase McCabe. On Nashville's best sports talk,
ESPN
102.5 The Game.
Second hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on this Friday morning. Hope everybody's having a good day thus far. Darren McFarland, Willie Donick, Chase McCabe with you. It's been a while since we've caught up with our next guest. He is a coach. He's the head coach at Lipscomb Academy. Man, we were talking about their wild one against CPA in the Blue Cross. You know, they had the championship game and back and forth affair, and we were watching it during our show. And unfortunately, Trent Dilfer and Lipscomb Academy come up a little bit short. But we are now joined by the former quarterback. He's on the line with us. Trent, how you doing?
Thanks for peeling back the Band-Aid.
Sorry.
Ripping off the scab.
Sorry.
I'm just kidding. No. Yeah, they got after us. Give them something to be motivated for in the offseason. So, I'm semi-back. I'd say I'm 65% recovered from it. It's only been a month and a half.
Well, in all seriousness, we've kind of went through this journey with you. I mean, where are you on where the state of the program? You have to be pleased where you are right now. Yes, you didn't win, but are you happy with the progression of where it's come from day one to where it's at today?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't be more proud of this community. And I said day one, it's going to take everybody that has. Just the entire community's rallied. Our boys have sacrificed so much. And I walked in day one, we had 38 kids, and six were lifting with the PVC pipe. We had 108. We had 108 to end the season. People moving in from all over the country, they're excited about what we're doing. Recruiting kids from the school, meaning kids that hadn't played football or basketball, baseball players, hadn't played a sport. They're engaged. I think we're really optimistic about where we're going. We're learning lessons. You know, 3 years ago, they won one game. We've been in the state semis and the state finals. So we feel pretty good about it. We know that the big bad CPA boys are going to be good every year, and we got to find a way to beat them consistently. So that's the objective of the offseason.
I know everybody went through it, but how difficult was this past season considering the circumstances we've all been in?
It was very difficult, but we took an approach early on. Let's not just try to survive. Let's try to thrive through this. And everybody bought into it, our administration especially, you know, just the amount of protocols we put in place, the amount of resources we devoted to keeping kids and coaches safe. But the kids have to do it. You know, they have to buy in. They have to be disciplined. They have to, you know, take breaks from one another. They have to physically distance. They have to, you know, limit their relationships outside of football. They got to clean every bar after they lift with it. They got to not be in the locker room. I can go on and on and on and on and on. Bring their own water bottles, fill their own water bottles up. Everybody dealt with it, but the kids actually have to do it for you to pull it off. And our kids' discipline, self-control was fantastic. Our coaching staff's ability to oversee it, and again, our administration's ability to put the protocols in place for us to be able to thrive, I think was really important. I think, you know, I said it early on, the team that would win state would handle COVID the best. Obviously, CPA handled it better than us. But if you look towards the end, the last four teams to play, I think in every division, public and private, there are also programs that took it very serious from day one, that put a system in place where kids could play a sport they love, they could grow physically, mentally, emotionally, and they were willing to make the sacrifices to do so.
When Derrick Henry broke the 2,000-yard plateau this season, after that game, the next week we had Jamal Lewis on. We had Terrell Davis. We had, you know, running backs that had been there, done it. And for whatever reason, as you know, the league is trying to diminish that position. And we've just talked about even more reason to prop up whenever they're doing it. They don't have really the bell cows anymore in the NFL. It's almost a committee in the backfield for a lot of teams. When you see what Derrick Henry did, and you can't even get mentioned in the MVP discussion, what do you think about that? And should there be something done where maybe you have, I'm sorry, I know I'm asking a quarterback this, maybe a quarterback award and then have everybody else in maybe a MVP award? What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I too think Derek should be mentioned in the MVP race. I do think, regardless of his fantastic season, I still think Aaron Rodgers has had the most incredible season of anybody, and I think he'll be a runaway for the MVP, even if Derek got the love he should get.
Yeah.
I like your idea about separating the awards. I think it's an interesting conversation. It's a big one you could always unpack, and probably guys could eat up a whole show with it, is there's no right or wrong whether the tailback has been minimized. Because there's people like Derek where he's the bell cow of the program, right? Everything runs through him. They play better defense when he's getting more touches. They can absorb offensive line injuries. Taylor Lewan, when you're giving him the ball rock, it makes your quarterback a much better player. Tannehill is a much better player now with Derrick Henry than he was in Miami. I can go on and on and on. There's also an argument about the economics around it. Like, teams that don't have that guy and use three guys that don't make a ton of money now can devote those resources elsewhere. So I don't think a team's right or wrong for choosing to invest into a tailback and making him the bell cow. It just is. And when you decide to do that, you know you're making sacrifices in other places. Now, what I think is unique about Derek and the Titans is they – how do I say this? I think they became too dependent on him at times. I think there's an argument, especially when they struggled defensively, that they could have got up on people earlier if they're a little more aggressive earlier and made teams play from behind a little bit more. I think that could have been advantageous to their season. But at the same time, it's hard not to turn around and hand the ball to that guy. He's awesome, and the more you give him the ball, the better he's going to be at the end of the game. So I will say this too. Last thing I would say, it's much harder to call a game as a play caller when you feel like you have to get your back X amount of touches so that he'll be rolling in the fourth quarter. Talked to a lot of these West Coast guys for years, and one of the reasons they like back by committee is because they don't feel the obligation to have to give the ball to the back seven times in each of the first three quarters so you've worn down the defense in the fourth quarter. It's an interesting dynamic, as I've talked to West Coast play callers, of why they choose not to have that bell cow back.
Yeah, interesting. I know that I always perk up, and I trust, you know, when someone like you talks about somebody, or when we have Tim Hasselbeck on, or Sean Salisbury, guys that have been there, done it, and played that position. I want to listen to what you think of that quarterback. And I remember we did a couple of shows over at your facility, and we talked on and off the air about your feelings about Tua, and I perked up. I mean, I wanted to hear what you have to say. You've been around the young man a lot. So what did you make of his first season? Now a lot of people are already ready to jump off the Tua bandwagon, and, you know, that's kind of silly in my opinion. But what do you think is ahead for him, and what did you see in the body of work that we saw, what little we did see this season?
I thought that he, first of all, the narratives around people jumping off the ship, I mean, that's just, it's ridiculous. And I've talked to people close to the program in Miami, and they're not. They love him. They're more excited about him now than when they drafted him because of how he handled everything. I think he played really, really well for a rookie that didn't have an off season. The problem was Herbert and Burrow early on played exceptionally well, so people would compare the three, and they were very different systems. You had two teams, the Chargers and the Bengals, that couldn't win a game to save their life, playing from behind and were kind of guns a-blazing, let's be reckless, let's go throw the ball over the yard. And then a Dolphins team that, you know, was trying to compete for a playoff spot all year long that was playing a little bit tighter to the vest, a little more conservatively. I thought the play calling didn't necessarily suit who he was. They didn't do the things that he could have done day one, you know, top 10 in the league. They reduced him a little bit. But I think at the same time, he was really good outside of one game, protecting the football, moving the chains, making good decisions, leading his team. I've heard rave reviews about him from his teammates, how he engaged and connected with them. I know there's a few guys that were on record saying they're not sure. It's easy to fight at a squad of 53 guys plus practice squad guys. It's pretty easy to go in and cherry pick three or four negative Nellies about anybody. I'm sure you can find three or four negative Nellies about anybody on the Titans too. So The people I've talked to rave about how he handled it. So for all those reasons and the shakeup in the coaching staff, I think the year two will really get to see a Tua that we all saw in college before the injury. That was the other thing, that all of a sudden that whole conversation went away. It all went away that he suffered a catastrophic injury at the end of his last season. He spent most of his offseason leading into the NFL rehabbing. He was far behind the other guys in physical development. He didn't get any quarterback development in the offseason outside the pre-draft stuff he did here in Nashville. And he had to learn a new playbook at the snap of a finger. So there was a lot of things working against him. And I think because considering all the circumstances, he did very well.
A lot of room to grow, no question. Trent Dilfer is with us, just picking his brain with all kinds of football questions here. And Trent, I know it's on a lot of people's minds right now with the Titans, is where you go from here with offense. You sort of set the table. We're talking about just what a force Derrick Henry is. But we know that you just can't do it every year, hand the ball to your running back 370-some-odd times. He can't do it every year. Maybe he could do it next year. But with a new offensive coordinator, what is the right balance of trying to keep what you have intact but also evolve and get the most out of everybody you have?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. Losing Arthur, who I think is one of the great coaches in the NFL, and his understanding of the wide zone scheme, which is the running scheme they use. The new coordinator has to kind of have a master's in that scheme, because that's what they're married to in the run game and all the iterations off of it. Here's what I would do. It's pretty simple. I mean, it goes way deeper than this, but I think the new offensive coordinator has to have a plan to supplement 75 to 100 runs from Derek, and you'll still get the dynamic qualities. You still get the game wrecker. You'll still get the guy who can finish out games. He's a little fresher. And I would add, 75% of those 100 plays, 100 carries we're going to take away from, I'd add to a quick RPO game. The first thing I would do is steal stuff from the college game. I'd get the ball on the perimeter to those talented receivers right away. So think of all the college games where it's kind of quick action fake and boom, the ball spit out the perimeter and the guys almost running line of scrimmage screens. But just thinking like 75%, kind of that quick RPO perimeter game to get the ball spread out to the other talented players to let them run with the ball. And then I think one thing they can really get better at is their screen game. Look at the four teams left. All four of them have dynamic screen games. I watched every Titans game. They do some good stuff. I'm not saying they're terrible at it, but I would invest more time, more resources into their running back screen game, tight end screen game. It's really a way you can slow down pass rush. You can use a lot of misdirection from it. You can get to the edges of the defense and get big guys on little guys. The Titans offensive line can really run and play out in space. So it's a way to get them out in space and just bulldozing little 195-pound corners and safety types. So I would really look at it that simply. Like, we're going to call the entire season the same except for 100 plays. We're going to take those 100 carries from Derek. 75 are going to be devoted to kind of the RPOs, quick perimeter game, and then 25% is going to be devoted to a screen game where we could utilize kind of the people around us.
You had some great answers when Darren was asking you about, the big picture, what you've accomplished as a head coach. Now you're talking X's and O's like a play caller. And this is the question. You have all these candidates who have been coordinators. Now they're making the jump to head coach for the first time. Arthur Smith is an example. What's the best piece of advice you can give for somebody that goes from being the play caller, where we know X's and O's are very important, but when you become the head guy and you're the CEO, what's the biggest adjustment?
Critical thinking, time management, connection. I think you have to critically think through everything. I was really lucky, really good. When I retired, they were trying to groom me as a general manager, so I spent a lot of time with the 49ers brass. And the amount of high-level decisions that nobody even knows are being made, you have to critically think through those things, because every little decision you make has a ripple effect. So you want to make sure your initial decisions are really good decisions, so that ripple effect is positive. You can't get overwhelmed by the bigness of what's going on. You really have to devote personal time to deep thinking through every scenario. You have to manage your time. I mean, even as a high school head coach, I walk into my board every morning and it's slotted. You know, I have 12 hours slotted for what my day looks like because I still have another life outside of this where I have to devote time to and you know, emotional energy, intellectual energy to. So you really have to manage your time well. And then you got to connect with people. I think that's the mistake that's made so often by coordinators is a lot of coordinators are locked up in their office. They're very exo-driven. They're very production-driven. And they lose connection with a bulk of the team. I think that's why Robert Saleh was so – people raved about him leaving the Niners because he carved out a portion of his day where he would go connect with the rest of the organization, whether it was front office, the other coaches on defense side of the ball, the players, the equipment staff, the training staff, maintenance staff. And there's a lot of people that are invested into the performance of the program, and you got to connect with those people. So I think that's the biggest mistake you see coordinators make is they go become head coaches and they lose that connection. They can be taught how to time manage. They've already critical thought at a high level because they've had a lot of responsibility, but they lose that ability to connect with their people and inspire them and make them feel important. I've always said, you know, the secret sauce to coaching is getting the most from the least and the best from the best. And the way you do that is by making everybody think they're a legend in their own mind. You really got to take a 138-pound kid that's lifting the PVC pipe and give him a vision for himself for how he's going to be great one day in life. You got to do the same thing for a free agent signing that walks in your doors in week six and doesn't know anybody and isn't sure if he's going to be there 2 days later. You got to create a vision for that person and make him feel like he's at a place where he can reach his personal potential. That's really where the great guys get it. That's why you see so many of them come from the same trees, the Parcellian tree, the Walsh tree, the Holmgren tree, whatever tree it is, because those guys got it. And these assistants watched that head guy do it for so long. And then when that head guy launched that new guy, he sat him down and said, hey, don't forget this, because this is what makes it all go.
We're talking to Trent Dilfer, a longtime NFL quarterback, Super Bowl winning quarterback and head coach at Lipscomb Academy. We've seen, as mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of these coordinators, these up-and-comers, they're getting their chance and getting jobs. But Eric Bieniemy still has not been named as a head coach. Now, he could go to Houston. Who knows what's going to happen there. But if he doesn't get a job, what is it you see from him that makes you think that teams aren't quite ready to give him that chance to be a head coach?
One, I don't know, and I think a lot of people are speaking into this without knowing what's going on. Here's what I know. I know he's picky, which is smart. He's not willing just to jump at any job, and I think that's wise. I think these guys that are eventually going to be head coaches in the NFL obviously make millions and millions of dollars and have a ton of power and control. They want to make sure they're aligned with the ownership. They want to make sure they're aligned with the general manager. They want to make sure there's personnel in place where they can be successful early, because if you're not successful early, you really start behind the eight ball. They want to make sure there's a great draft plan for building the program. If they don't hear those answers, I think some of these interviews, it's the coordinator interviewing the ownership and general manager as much as they're interviewing him. So he's picky, for one, which I appreciate. And then I don't know the other reason. You know what I mean? I think people are speaking into this on TV, and they don't know what's going on. They don't know what they're looking for. They don't know how Eric's interviewing. And if Eric, say he interviews bad, as it's been reported, who's the guy that's calling and saying he interviewed bad? Think about that. There's only four guys in the room. One of those guys, you know, somebody's calling a reporter and saying, oh, he was a terrible interview. Why are they doing that? What's the motivation behind that? And I think that's what bothers me about this process every year is who's leaking this stuff and what's their motivation? I just think it's bad ball how it all gets handled. I know I've talked to a lot of people with the Chiefs. A lot of people have been around Eric a long time, going back to his time in Colorado. He definitely will be a head coach at some point, but he's going to be a head coach where he wants to be a head coach. He's not just going to jump for one of these jobs. And I think that's smart. I think the biggest mistake made This is why you see the Jimmy Tomasulas of the world. Probably won't even be coaching in the NFL this year after he got fired by the Redskins as defensive line coach. You know, they jump at the wrong job and they're not ready, and they just shorten their career by 10, 15, 20 years.
Now, you play the position, you study the position, you work with quarterbacks. With Urban Meyer going to Jacksonville, that he's obviously got a learning curve with the NFL. But it appears Trevor Lawrence is going to be his quarterback. What are some things that you see that he needs to work on to take his next steps in the NFL?
Well, I think it's a really unique dynamic in Jacksonville. I think a couple things are going on. Number one, they have arguably the best player personnel guy in all of football as now their general manager, Trent Baalke. So he was wildly successful with the Niners, had some relational stuff that came up over time, especially Jim Harbaugh. It ended poorly, but I think around league circles, he's considered maybe the best personnel mind in all of football. So they're going to restructure the roster. I think where Trent had struggled, and I don't think he will his second time around, but where I think he struggled at the Niners with some relational stuff as the years went on, Urban's great at that stuff. So they're going to be a great team. I think Urban's going to really take a CEO approach to this. A Parcellian approach to this, hire really strong coordinators that have done it for years, hire really strong position coaches, and then set the culture and set the expectations for the entire organization with those strong people he puts in place. I don't think Trevor Lawrence is a done deal, personally. I think the gap between him and Justin is not as wide as many thought for a long time. I think, again, that was a narrative that started gaining momentum, and everybody, it was easier to jump on that bandwagon than it was to jump off of it. I still think Trevor's the best player in the draft. I just don't think the gap is as wide as everybody's saying. And then the real caveat to that is Urban Meyer wants to run his quarterback. Go back to Utah. Go back to Bowling Green. Go back to every one of his stops. And he is a big believer in his quarterback having the ability to run. And now that that's an acceptable thing to do in the NFL with your quarterback, if you're discerning about it, I think Justin Fields all of a sudden has value for that fit more so than he did before Urban Meyer got that job and before Darren Bevell got that coordinator job. Because I guarantee you this, they're sitting in their rooms right now, and they're on the boards, and they're on watching tape, and they're saying, huh, yeah, Trevor's better at A, B, C, and D, but boy, E, F, and G, Justin is fantastic, and we do a lot of the stuff that Justin is fantastic at. So I do think this is going to be more of a conversation as we get closer to the draft.
He is Trent Dilfer, the head coach at Lipscomb Academy and also Super Bowl winning quarterback. Trent, we appreciate the time, as always. Good to catch up with you.
Always fun to be with you guys. See ya.
Have a good one. Trent Dilfer building a program there at Lipscomb Academy. When we come back, we will head over to Knoxville. You'll hear the introductory press conference with Danny White. That's all next. ESPN 102.5 The Game.